What I want to talk about is a problem which is entertaining. I think this is too loud. I would prefer not to use the microphone. So I'd like to talk about this problem which is entertaining. It has not so much to do with additive combinatorics, where much means anything. It does have something to do with number theory, and you'll see there's some harmonic analysis that comes in peripherally. But it's a good story, and I think it's fun for me, at least. And it's intelligible, I think, so you don't have to really know what's going on to see what's happening here. So quintic equations, right? So we're going to talk about Diophantine equations. So, of course, to talk about quintic equations, I'm going to spend a long time talking about cubic equations, because cubics are, like quintics, only easier. So here's a cubic equation. I'm just thinking of the general homogeneous equation of degree 3. The coefficients are going to be integers, and this has some number of variables s, which you should think of as being relatively large. Not 3 or 2. Well, 3, like Andrew's elliptic curves, but some much larger number of variables, higher dimensions. And so this story begins in the 1950s. There was a race. Well, nobody knew there was a race going on until the race had finished, I suppose. But there was a race to solve the cubic equation. So how many variables do you need to guarantee that a cubic equation with integral coefficients has a non-trivial integral solution? So a solution other than the zero solution, where all the coordinates are zero. So what is this number S0, which is sufficient to guarantee existence of solutions if you have at least S0 variables? And why do we care? Because this is all part of the great quest to solve Diophantine equations. And if that's not a good enough reason for you, then I will talk to you later, but never mind. You've got to be interested in solving equations, right? So first observation is linear equations are easy, because that's what we're trained to do in primary school or kindergarten, wherever. And quadratic equations are not so easy, but they're quite containable. So there's results from the late part of the 19th century and early 20th century, which give you a hat of principle for quadratic equations. And in particular, if you have a quadratic equation that happens to have a non-trivial real solution and at least 5 variables, then that's enough to guarantee the existence of an integral solution. So we're happy. So cubic equations are nice because they have odd degree, they're homogeneous, so they automatically have solutions over the reals. But of course there could be other local obstructions to solubility. And this was a problem which was resolved very nicely by Demjanov and Lewis in the early 50s. So you have p-adic solutions everywhere, provided you have more than 9 variables. And if you don't like thinking about p-adics, then just think about congruences modulo prime powers. So you have solutions modulo every prime power if you have at least 10 variables, more than 9 variables. So both the local part of the problem is wrapped up. I mean, we know about real solutions and these mod power of p solutions. What about the integral solutions? And that's where the problem which I stated before comes in. And this was solved in 1957, more or less simultaneously by Birch, Davenport, and Lewis. And there's sort of documentary evidence for this which you can find in the literature. So there's a volume of Mathematica, volume 4, which has an editorial note. And I should point out that the editor was actually Harold Davenport at the time, so I guess he knew what he was doing. And he said, it's a curious coincidence that a problem which has been known for many years should have been solved independently in a matter of months by 3 mathematicians. And then he lists the order of priority for these results. He lists Lewis first, himself, the mysterious editor second, and Birch last. And Birch's paper appears in this volume of Mathematica, as does Lewis's paper. This was the note to Lewis's paper. And then Davenport's work was published elsewhere. So, in fact, there were 3 completely different arguments involved in establishing the same theorem. So the problem which I mentioned is a corollary of the main theorems of each of these three papers, and a corollary in different ways, so there are different approaches. And I'll be interested in one of these approaches, the approach of Lewis, actually, but I'll quickly sketch what goes on in the other two approaches, because, well, inquiring minds must know, right? So you should understand roughly what happens. And so Davenport's approach, which was the second, is actually the most economical in terms of the number of variables that you need, so it gives the best bound for S0. And that involves harmonic analysis versus a circle method. So, and I'm not really going to talk about this for a change. So the idea is that you look at the Fourier coefficients corresponding to values of the cubic polynomial with integer choices for the variables, and you try to count up how many times you hit zero. And so there's analysis involving the size of this exponential sum close to rational points. And if you are as clever as Davenport, then you're able to derive an asymptotic formula for the number of solutions in this way, for the size of this integral, which is effective in the first instance, at least if you have 32 or more variables. So it involves Weyl differencing and all the other good stuff that we're familiar with from the circle method. But I'm not talking about that. I'll just note that Davenport managed to refine this method so that you get such information when you have 16 or more variables. And for a long time, that was the best result on the problem. So if you have a homogeneous cubic polynomial with integral coefficients, it definitely has a non-trivial integral zero if you have 16 or more variables. And this has been improved very recently by Heath Brown to 14 variables, which is the best, the world record on this problem now. So for local abstractions, if you have only 9 variables, at least potential local abstractions, if you happen to have a non-singular cubic, then 10 variables are enough. And if you're prepared to assume local information, then 9 variables are enough. So these results of Heath Brown from the early 80s and Hooley a little time after that. Okay, so that's all stuff which is complicated to explain properly. S0 for local reasons would be at least 9. So for examples of cubic forms which are built up of copies of norm forms which have 9 variables and fail to have p-adic solutions for suitable p. If you are interested in the Hasse principle, then the Hasse principle fails with 4 variables and presumably holds with 5 variables, although nobody can prove that. Nobody that I know of can prove that in this life. So then there's the second technique, there's Birch's technique, which is very elementary. And my coffee's disappeared, here we go. It's very elementary. So the idea is to observe that additive things are easy to understand. Well, of course, the whole point of this meeting is that that's not usually the case. But at least from the point of view of solving equations, the additive things are easier to understand because you have nice properties of Fourier analysis. So the circle method works very well. So his idea was to use this observation to try to get better estimates. And so given a general homogeneous form, you could try to diagonalize this form. Now for quadratics, of course, you can diagonalize quadratics by completing the square. But for high degree, that's not something you can do without losing information. So the real strategy is that you want to find some big set of linearly independent vectors, integral vectors, that's called U1 up to U sub t, with the property that when you evaluate with your favorite cubic form, F, on this linear combination of these vectors, then the result is diagonal. So you can always do this for very trivial reasons when t equals 1, because it doesn't matter what vector u I choose, f of z times u is z cubed times f of u. So that's not exciting and not useful either. But you can, there's a way to engineer the problem so that you can allow t to increase slowly with u, So as the number of variables in the qubit form increases, you get to take t to be larger and larger, and then you have the chance to solve this diagonal cubic, where you have much better knowledge, and that's the sort of basis of Birch's idea. So just to summarize what comes out of these ideas, so a bit of notation which you can carefully ignore in a moment. So I'll just call phi sub d of k for any field k, think of the rationals for example. This is going to be the smallest number s1 with the property that if you have more than s1 variables, then any diagonal form with coefficients from the field has a non-trivial solution. So linear stuff is easy, so if phi is always 1 for linear things, because if you have two variables then you have solutions, that's trivial. Quadratics, over the rationals or over the reals, this number is not finite because you have definite forms. And so that's just summarizing that. And over the periodic numbers, there's a result of Davenport and Lewis, which shows that v squared plus one variables are enough to solve these forms. So this is sort of basic input. And this was an idea which actually has its genesis in work of Brouwer. So Brouwer was interested in trying to solve general homogeneous equations actually from the point of view of a certain Hilbert problem. And he'd worked out that if you could solve diagonal equations of every degree, then there was an inductive argument which showed that you can solve general homogeneous equations of any degree if they have enough variables in terms of the number of variables you require in all these periodic equations or these degree I equations in whatever field you're interested in. Of course, these inductive arguments are not clean. The nested loops, which tend to blow up the number of variables dramatically. So if you make this all precise, you get a mess. But the mess gives something which is reasonably tidy for the periodic numbers at least. So if you want to solve a periodic equation of degree d, the general homogeneous form, then you need only d to the 2 to the d variables at worst. So anyway, that's all for periodics and fields where you have good control of forms, diagonal forms of degree I for every I. It doesn't tell you what happens for cubics yet, so this is a diversion. And the problem is that you have these definite forms, right? So you have things like these sums of squares, which, as I pointed out, sums of squares over the rational numbers never take the zero value unless all the variables are zero. So one way around this, as was carefully spotted by Peck in 1949, is to restrict attention to purely imaginary fields, like the Gaussian numbers, where you don't have definite forms anymore. And so then the same argument works. And this is significant for what comes later, actually. So Lewis actually made use of this observation in his argument for cubics. So again, you can make this all effective, and you get worse bounds from before. Well, they're still doubly exponential, right? So that's... If anybody works on Ramsey theory, I should feel really proud by comparison with only doubly exponential bounds. This is okay, right? So just to give you a sketch of the idea involved in this, so that you sort of, in principle, believe what happens when I talk about what Birch really did, let's just think about some general homogeneous form of degree d and see how diagonalization might work. So if I just expand, if I take two vectors, u and v, say, integral vectors, or vectors with coordinates from the field k in this case, and just expand some general linear combination of these objects, then, well, I get sort of diagonal parts involving t to the d and w to the d here. These are the sort of parameters in the linear combination. And then I get a whole bunch of cross terms. These cross terms are bihomogeneous polynomials, homogeneous in each variable. of degree I and D minus I, let's say, where I is going from 1 up to D minus 1. So if I have enough variables in the original form, then I could try fixing one of the sets of variables U and solve for the other set of variables V. Right, so this is a system now of D minus 1 forms of degree 1 up to D minus 1 in S variables. And if I had enough variables, maybe I could solve this system of smaller degree than the original system, and then I would be happy. So you can see there's some scope for some induction here. So it's in some sense smaller than the original problem. Right. There are more equations, but they're lower degree at least, so that's good. And so, well, I mean, if that all worked, then I would have selected vectors U and V so that this form at least is diagonalizable to some form in two variables. Two is better than one, which is what I started off with. So then you have to sort of soup this all up and play a nested induction game where you try to get big linear spaces to work with and then solve these systems of equations that crop up on these linear spaces. And if you're very careful, then you'll get the sort of effective bounds which I mentioned earlier. So then, if you can diagonalize in enough variables, as I said, let's say you can get phi plus one variables, then if any diagonal form in phi plus one variables does have a non-trivial solution, that gives me a non-trivial solution of the original equation. So the only input you have in this whole method is diagonal equations. They're supposed to be easier. Beyond that, it's essentially linear algebra. So this is very elementary, and therefore very robust as well. So works for any field for which you have this information on the diagonal equations. Okay, so this actually is Brouwer's idea. Now, Birch, of course, has this obstruction to deal with, but diagonal forms of even degree can be definite. And yet he was still able to surmount this, at least if the forms have odd degree. So if a form has odd degree, then it's indefinite. So at least you stand a chance of being able to solve it. So think of K as being the rational numbers here. So if you have a form of odd degree over the rationals, it does have a non-trivial rational solution, provided that all the diagonal forms of odd degree also have non-trivial solutions if they have enough variables in terms of their degree. And the idea here is similar to Birch's idea. So just to give a flavor of the motivation, what underlies the idea, the methods. So look at an expansion once again of a linear combination of two vectors, and observe that you can split the cross terms into parts where, let's say, the index I is odd and the index j is even, which means that the index d minus j is odd if d is odd. So there's sort of odd aspects to both of the cross terms here. So if you think about the variables that occur in one of these forms, they all have odd degree in the first variable u and odd degree in this last variable v in the other set. So you can imagine that there's some way to sort of try to imitate what Brouwer was doing for these forms of odd degree now. Restrict only to odd degree. But this is all pretty inefficient. So Birch comments that these bounds are not even astronomical. It's one of my favorite phrases from the subject, because they're not even astronomical. You can get sort of tower exponential type bounds, and this is the best that's known actually for this problem, which helps justify why we should look at quintic equations, right? So equations of degree 7 and higher require absurdly many variables in the best state of knowledge to solve them. At least that's what I'm suggesting. Cubics, well, so 14 variables are enough. So quintics, inquiring minds must know what happens for quintics. And well, I did actually think about this problem earlier, and I actually have this general result about finding linear spaces of rational solutions on quintic equations, and the bounds are big, And in particular, as a corollary, the number of variables you need to solve a single quintic equation over the rationals or over the integers is at worst 10 to the 10 to the 32. Okay. It's not even astronomical. It's much bigger than astronomical, yes. So we shall try to improve this bound. Not just by saving one variable, we will try to improve it quite a lot. So the strategy is related to this argument of Lewis, which is the third technique for looking at cubic equations. So what was Lewis doing? Well, it's a beautiful idea. I mean, this is one of the most beautiful ideas I saw on Daffenton equations when I was in short pants. And I don't wear them in the summer, unlike much of North America. So the idea is to, we need a bit of notation, but the idea is to look in field extensions and try to use the fact that you've got more room in a field extension of your favorite fields, like the rational numbers. And so if you're trying to solve an equation with coefficients from some ground field, if you look in a field extension, you should stand a better chance of being able to solve the equation. Of course, this is a well-known principle. If I extend to the whole of the complex numbers, then the problem becomes very easy. So the idea is to choose some relatively low-degree field extension and hope that you can sort of pull these points back somehow. So here's a bit of notation. Really, you can ignore this. There's some pictures coming up, incidentally, so you can space out and think about the pictures in a moment. So the idea is that if I have some parameter here, gamma of Rm, and this tells me how large a linear space, dimension n, let's say, of rational solutions I can find in a system of R cubic equations with coefficients all from my favorite field. So let's say you could think of K as being Q here. And so just to fix ideas, what this means is that gamma of 1, 0 is the same as the number of variables I need to solve a cubic, actually one fewer. There's this convention about this V sub 3, which we had before. And then what Lewis showed was that this number is finite for every R and M, for any field extension K of Q. So Birch's argument was also robust in terms of the field. Davenport's was just fixed in the rational field. And as we'll see, in principle, this can give reasonable bounds, this idea, unlike Birch's method. So as a corollary of this, then, with some finite number of variables, so this number S0 is finite, you can actually solve cubic equations over Q. And so the strategy is to work in a purely imaginary field extension of your favorite field, like the Gaussian field, for example, and then try to pull points back from that field to the rational numbers. I have to show you how to do that. And remember, Peck's theorem told us how to solve equations in purely imaginary field extensions, and so you could use Peck's theorem to guarantee the existence of these points. And so the idea is to, as I said, to use the fact that working in field extensions ought to be easier. So let me go to, this one. Technical difficulties briefly, yeah. Okay, here we go. Okay, so here's, as you will recognize instantly, a cubic hypersurface. It's my cartoon of a cubic hypersurface. So this is a generalization of the picture that Andrew wrote down earlier. So this is supposed to be the solution set of a cubic form. It's a cartoon, right? So what does it matter? And what are we going to do? So we're going to suppose that we can find some rational point in a purely imaginary field extension of our favorite field. So think of this as being a point in the Gaussians. So this is this P here, which you can see. Well, okay, I need a laser pointer that works with sort of split beams or something. Okay, so what are we going to do? So this is the oldest trick in the trade, in some sense. You conjugate that point. Okay, so here's the conjugate of a point. So if you think about sort of point in a Gaussian field extension, I'm just switching I to minus I. And now when I conjugate everything in sight, well, the cubic surface is supposed to have coefficients from the ground field. Think of the rational numbers. And so the cubic surface stays the same if I conjugate everything in sight. And conjugation just swaps P and P star back and forth between each other. So as you learn in kindergarten, whenever you see two points on a page, you draw the line between them. And now we have a line that intersects a cubic in two points. Well, by Bazou's theorem, a line that intersects a cubic in two points has to intersect in a third point. And so we've got a third point Q. And it's fixed under conjugation, because conjugation just swaps P and P star back and forth. So Q has to stay in the same place. So Q had better be fixed under conjugation, so it's rational. Okay, so very good. So now we've got a rational point on our qubit, provided that we could find a point in this imaginary field extension, this purely imaginary field extension of the rationals. Okay, so this is an old idea. I'm not sure who first came up with this. Maybe we have lots of expertise in the audience. Somebody might actually have a conjecture as to the real answer, but it's certainly very old. And Lewis was not the first to spot this. So certainly that means that you can find points in Q by looking in field extensions. Lewis actually had a very nice idea, which in the paper doesn't have a geometrical interpretation, but later on, after an embarrassingly long period of time, I found a geometrical interpretation. He has it all written down in terms of equations. And so this is about finding linear spaces of solutions in cubics. And the idea is as follows. So now we'll suppose that we've already found a rational point in our cubic hypersurface. You'll have spotted, of course, this was a cubic hypersurface, because we covered that issue before. So now what I'm going to do is try to find a rational line inside the cubic hypersurface. And the way I'll do this is I'll start with my rational point, P, and I'll try to find a point, Q, in a purely imaginary field extension of Q, so of my ground field. So this is, think of this as being in the Gaussians, let's say. And I'll suppose that I found this point Q in such a way that actually the whole line here running through PQ is actually contained inside the cubic hypersurface. So as we'll see in a moment, this just means that you're solving a whole bunch of equations of degree 3, 2, and 1 over this field extension of Q, L. You'll get an idea of how that works in a moment. So it's something that one can do. Okay, so now we have a line contained in this field extension, and we can conjugate it. So here's the conjugate line in red, or if you're colorblind, in green. And you'll see that there's a conjugate point Q star here. So we've got Q and Q star, we've got two conjugate lines. And now, as an advanced topic in which should be taught in kindergarten but isn't, when you see two lines in a picture, you should always construct a plane containing those two lines, right? So here's a plane shaded out here, which is spanned by the two lines. The two lines intersect in a point, so this really is a plane here. And now, by the proper generalizations of Bazou's theorem, so if you have sort of some fairly simple intersection theory, you know that if you have a plane that intersects a cubic in two lines, then there has to be a third line also contained in the cubic hypersurface. And again, this third line, which is, I don't know, brown or something, I'm not sure what color that is, is this third line here, is fixed under conjugation. And because conjugation just swaps the two lines we already know about, PQ and PQ star. And so this third line is fixed under conjugation, so it has to be rational. Okay. Now things can go wrong with both of these strategies, because maybe it was the case that actually PQ and PQ star, this plane that was spanned here, was already sitting inside the cubic hypersurface. Then that's even better, because then we've got a whole plane which is fixed under conjugation, and so we've got a rational plane inside the hypersurface, and everything's good. And, you know, various other possible degenerate cases can occur, which are always good. So you can see this is, you know, and this generalizes to higher dimensional objects as well. So that's all good. It means that we can pull points back from these field extensions to the rationals, for cubics at least. And so just to give you an idea of how you know, this business with finding these linear spaces goes, give you a bit of notation. So you have a cubic, you write down sort of a trilinear form, and then there are these other things. So you don't need to worry about this. All you need to observe is that these are sort of degree 2 with respect to one variable, 1 with respect to the other, or the other way around, or degree 1 with respect to everything. And so then this lemma, which is equivalent to what Lewis was doing, is you start with some set of vectors from your favorite field, your ground field, V1 up to Vn, with the property that any linear combination, when you use the cubic form to evaluate that object, you get 0. And then you try to solve some system of equations, which is defined in terms of all these trilinear forms which I had before. If you can solve these in the field extension, then you get to find sort of n plus 1 vectors spanning a larger dimensional linear space, all in the ground field on which the cubic vanishes. So it's just what I drew in pictures, only now I'm telling you what sort of equations you have to solve. So, and then if you do this all properly, you can actually count up how many equations of every degree, and you can sort of really go to work on evaluating how many variables you need. And it's not very many to get these linear spaces. It grows at worst quadratically. This is much better than Birch. So now you can solve two equations if you like, because you can find a big enough space in one equation to solve the other. And you can get semi-plausible bounds on all these things. Improves on some earlier work of Schmidt. So if it bounds in 3 digits, which is a victory in this kind of game. The real answer is 19 for this problem, I'm sure, but this is not bad. Okay, so I'm running out of time, clearly, and I need to get to Quintic. So what about Quintic? Well, for a long time, this idea, you'll notice that this is an additive structure here. For a long time, I was unable to find any application for that beautiful idea other than cubics. And it's such a beautiful idea, you have to figure it ought to be useful somewhere else. So finally there's a way to use this for quintics, which is the point of me giving this talk. So let's think now about a form of higher degree, actually. Needn't be 5 so far. And let me tell you about a result of Schmidt, which does give away to give an upper bound on the number of variables you need to find non-trivial solutions of these equations. And this involves this H invariant. So H of your polynomial F is the smallest number H, which has the property that you can rewrite F as a sum of products of two polynomials of positive degree over the rationals, let's say. I mean, there are different ways of setting this up, but this is sufficient. So it's not at all obvious how you actually compute this number. Not obvious to me, anyway. And as you'll see, it's very important to be able to work out the relationship between H and the certain properties of a polynomial, like how big the singular locus of its zero set is. But anyway, this is all a mystery. So this theorem of Schmidt, which I'll give you in bite-sized chunks, it says, first of all, let's define this number depending on the degree, which grows rapidly. And let's suppose that the H invariant of your favorite form is big enough in terms of this big number and the number of variables you needed to get p-adic solutions, which we already talked about. Then you get an asymptotic formula for the number of solutions. This all goes by the circle method, which is basically the expected size. And so you're actually showing that the number of solutions of the form is positive, provided you have local solubility, and provided the number of variables is big enough. And big enough is measured in terms of this number here. It's big. So here's the strategy for quintic forms. Either H of F, the H invariant of your form, is big enough to apply the theorem of Schmidt, or else it's small and you have to think of something else to do. But if the H invariant is small, then you can rewrite F as a relatively small number of I sounded as if I'd been smoking there. That's interesting. Okay, a small number of products of two forms, right? So H is relatively small here. And because the degree of F is 5, one of A1 and B1 has a degree either 3 or 1, if it is a product of two things of positive degree. So now we could just solve, without loss of generality, we can just make A sub I be these objects of odd degree. We can just try to solve the system A1 equals A2 and so on, all equal to 0, which definitely gives me a 0 of the form. And then I'll be happy. So now, instead of solving a quintic, I'm solving for some relatively small h, a system of, at worst, cubic equations. They might all be cubic equations. And then I get a rational point on the quintic. So, unfortunately, we don't know so much about systems of cubic form. So in the current state of knowledge, if you just plug in what we know, you'll get an upper bound for the number of variables, which is 10 to the 194, which is much better than 10 to the 10 to the 32. But stop. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is try to look for singular solutions of the quintic. And the motivation here is that we have a theorem of Birch which tells us that non-singular quintics with p-adic points do have solutions. So we have to deal with singular quintics anyway. So here's the second version of the strategy. So given a quintic form, either H of F is large enough to apply the above strategy, or else it's small again, exactly the same as before. But now we're going to solve the bigger system. We're going to make sure that all of the A's and all of the B's simultaneously vanish. Now, of course, the B's have even degree. They might be definite. But we can do this over a quadratic field extension of Q, I'd say the Gaussians. So now we have to find a way to pull points back to pull Gaussian solutions of this back to points on that actually have rational coordinates. At least in principle, this is not so bad. This is something which is doable. And the number of variables you need isn't that much. Well, it's actually better than the corresponding problem for systems of cubics over Q, because we have better control in this bigger field. Okay. And I'll point out that these solutions that we're finding are necessarily singular, because if I look at the partial derivatives of F, they have no choice but to vanish just by using the product rule or whatever it is. Okay, so now we have to use a geometrical argument once again. So let's see. And yeah, time is running out, which is good, I suppose. Okay, oops, technical problem once again. Let's see. Yeah. Holy mackerel. Okay, finally. Yeah, okay, so you'll recognize that this is indeed a quintic hypersurface. So now, what I'm telling you is that at least with some reasonable number of variables, I can arrange so that I get a singular point in this quadratic field extension sitting on the quintic. And you'll notice it's singular because it's at least a double point, as you can see from the picture. So now what we play the same game again, right? So now we've got a conjugate double point, P star, and when we see double points, we join them together by a line. And okay, so now we've got a line which hits the quintic in, well, 2 points P and another 2 points P star. So there has to be a fifth point by Bazou sitting on the quintic, which is fixed under conjugation. So this fifth point is necessarily rational. Okay, so we've got a rational point sitting on the quintic. Now things could go wrong. Maybe this was actually a triple point instead of a double point. So then we'd have two triple points. That's the line then has intersection multiplicity 6 with the quintic, so the line actually is forced to be contained inside the quintic hypersurface already. So then we've got lots of rational points. And if the situation is worse than that, then yeah, obviously we do correspondingly better. Excellent. Okay, so that's the name of the game there. It's easy to pull these points, these singular points, back to the rational field. And we're just about done. So now, just comment that you can apply a similar idea to take care of the p-adic solubility problems. And then, it turns out, so this is the world record bound, which you can all be disappointed with, but it's something you can say in words. It's only 138 trillion variables. So with 138 trillion variables, you do get to find rational points on inside any quintic hypersurface. Excellent. And this all comes from solving implicitly 1,664 simultaneous cubics and quadratics over the Gaussians. Okay, and so let me finish by saying that there's actually scope for thinking further about this. I mean, one thing one can try to play with higher degree field extensions. That seems hard. The other issue is that one can try to analyze additive decompositions of polynomials as products of more than two polynomials. And this is something which really hasn't been explored very much so far, but actually offers a sort of a much more efficient route at this kind of problem. So in summary, I mean, this is a method that sort of combines aspects of the circle method and this work, sort of pulling points back from field extensions, and gives you at least something which is a semi-reasonable number of variables for solving quintics. So it's the start of a different way of approaching these problems. Okay, so I'm done. Thank you for your time.